Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, and this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
I hate math.
Is this really math?
It's mathy.
It's mathy. I guess there are numbers involved.
Counting is math-ish.
Okay. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Jane Costin, ProPublica's Dara Lind. We're going to switch things up. We're going to do a pandemic white paper today, but then talk about something that, like much of American life, is impacted by the pandemic, but really is fundamentally a sort of broader concern, which is we are doing a decennial census this year, 2020. These things happen every 10 years, and it's a great weeds topic because, like, officially, the census is this kind of nerdy statistical exercise that attempts to ascertain how many people live in where they live and, you know, some stuff about their households. But in fact, it's always an incredible political hot button because it's not sort of just for general interest. Like, we might be curious how many people live in Idaho, but the census is the basis for a lot of important political decision making, the allocation of money to different places, but also the allocation of political representation. And ever since Donald Trump became president, there's been a sort of series of controversies about, I guess, Dara, I mean, you probably know this best, but like the question of, like, are they trying to undercount immigrants in order to manipulate the representation, right?
Right. Longtime Weeds listeners will remember that when the Supreme Court was considering whether to allow the Trump administration to go forward with adding a citizenship question to the census, we spent a certain amount of time talking about that. The theory of the case of why you would want to add a citizenship question is kind of twofold, right? There's the argument that if red states wanted to use that information to redraw their districting maps when they have to do that anyway, in such a way that it counts, you know, eligible voters instead of all people, that's going to, relative to what we have now, disenfranchise people in immigrant-heavy areas. The other argument is kind of a broader chilling effect argument that just being asked about citizenship would have made a lot of people, Latinos in particular, less likely to fill out their census forms at all and create a demographic skew that didn't previously exist. What you have to remember again about the census is, like, we talk about a lot of social science on the weeds. And so there's a certain extent to which you can assume that if you know that there's a gap in your data, you can model your way out of it, or at least try to do so. The census does not allow that form of modeling. There's not, you can't do any kind of statistical imputation. So if there's a worry that there's going to be a certain skew in the data, just in terms of who's sending their forms back to you or willing to answer the door, that's going to be a problem. Now, you know, as you probably recall, the Supreme Court told Trump, you're not allowed to, on this super constrained time schedule and without having offered any valid reason or even tried to present a valid reason, you can't just add the citizenship question. The concern in terms of the chilling effect is that the damage has already been done. The thing about chilling effects is that they're not very easy to fix with just having the news stories say that something isn't happening anymore, right? It requires a lot more trust building and outreach to people who may not be as perfectly well informed as regular Weeds listeners. The concern about the data side, the kind of using it for redistricting on the meanwhile, is that the Trump administration reacted to its defeat at the Supreme Court by issuing an executive order saying, all right, everybody in the executive branch has to work together to do the best we can to map the census data onto citizenship data anyway. And so even though you can't change the census results by imputing added citizenship data from databases the government already has, depending on how exactly they do this, the government could produce official reports that say, hey, the census says there are this many people in this area. We have reason to believe that that X number of them aren't citizens, and that theoretically, you know, subject to future Supreme Court litigation, I'm sure, but states could go from there.
Right. And then thinking outside of the issues facing undocumented folks, there's also just how electoral maps are being drawn. There's an urge from the Trump administration, or a suggestion more or less, when he announced the executive order regarding the Census Bureau estimating citizenship data using state records, that you could draw electoral districts in 2021 based on where eligible voters live, not based on total population, which would, I think some social scientists have argued, said that that would basically hand more power to rural Republican areas and take it away from highly Democratic, highly urbanized areas, which has been a concern all this time about this particular census. It's interesting now to have gone through multiple census taking environments that take place in a specific political context. I don't know if listeners remember the 2010 census, which was very much in the era of the Tea Party, and it was very much of an era of the government asking a lot of questions about where people live was being a big concern for some people. But now it's interesting because now it's a different administration, and so some of the concerns from some have been specifically lessened.
Right. The fundamental policy importance of the census is, for one thing, this electoral, you know, redistricting policy. And there, you know, just to go over some things that most people are probably familiar with, you know, the federal government tells states, based on your census data, here's how many congressional representatives you get. And then states are responsible for drawing, you know, their lines based on their own assessments of, you know, what that data says. So the kind of ratchet this creates for what Jane was talking about with rural Republican advantage is states that are controlled by Republicans, but that are growing demographically due to non-Republican demographics, Texas being like the paramount example of this. Texas is expected to gain congressional seats in the next census. And it's not because there are more rural Republicans who are moving into being born in the state. So they are going to get their top line state number from the federal government and then get to use it to, you know, best advantage incumbents, best advantage the incumbent party, best advantage the kinds of voters that they want to empower, with the Voting Rights Act providing a not super clear at this point check, given the end of the requirement for DOJ to, you know, clear maps in advance to actually stop that from happening. So there's that. And then there's also the concern about the number of federal and state programs where money is dispersed based on the census reports of the population. And that's a lot of the argument that gets made in these kind of grassroots outreach campaigns. You know, in 2010, there were big urban campaigns about, like, if we don't know how many children we have, how do we know how many schools we need? That sort of, you know, how do we know how many playgrounds we need?
No, nobody says on their posters, it's important to fill out your census form so that we can draw state legislative districts that are more favorable to us. Like, what they emphasize is, we need to get our HUD money, we need to get our education money. And it's, of course, like, it's both of those things. And traditionally, the desire to get local program funding has been like a check on the impulse to manipulate things politically, that, you know, whatever it is you think about who's voting for whom in Ohio, you like kind of want your numbers to be high so that you can get money from federal grant formulas, right?
Right. You certainly don't want people not responding to the census in Ohio in areas where they wouldn't be voting for you.
Right.
You know, you want them to respond to the census, and then like you and the state legislature can do whatever your state laws and federal courts allow you to do to redistrict.
I think to step back, you know, back to the 18th century or whatever, that one of the things that's happened is that there used to be like the census. And now over time, we've developed sort of two separate censuses, censi or something
censi.
Like that, right?
We're going with censi.
So, you know, they wrote the Constitution in the late 18th century, and it says that every 10 years, there has to be this enumeration of the population, and that we're going to use that to decide how many house districts everybody gets. So that's all pretty loosey-goosey. And they start doing it, and there's, you know, infamously a three-fifths compromise. And so they have to set up a government department, the Census Bureau, to do this enumerating. And then sort of at first blush, it's like, okay, as long as we have people going around trying to count how many people live here and there, we should have them also ask some other questions that, you know, might be of interest. And so if you look up old census forms, it'll like say what jobs people have and other things like that. And it's because you have this constitutional mandate to conduct the census, it's also smart to have the census collect statistical information about the United States of America. Over time, technology changes, statistical techniques get developed, and they start saying, look, there's lots of good ways to get survey information about what's happening in America that don't require you to knock on every single person's door and fill out a form saying, like, here's what's going on here. And so the Census Bureau's output becomes increasingly elaborate. Like the Census Bureau publishes monthly retail trade statistics. You may have read in the newspaper this week that purchases at furniture stores fell 89%. That's the Census Bureau. Like that's what the census does. And so decades ago, the idea came forward that since these statistical techniques are powerful, and since if you try to run around counting every single human being, you are guaranteed that you are going to undercount. Because, like, you just will miss some people, and you're not going to say it mistakenly think a pigeon is a human being. They said, okay, well, we should use statistical inferences to estimate the total size of the American population. And the view of the statisticians was that this would reduce undercounting, and particularly would reduce undercounting of immigrants, of people who have unstable housing, of African Americans, things like that. And so that was going to sort of blow up the numbers of Democratic-leaning cities in particular. And so Republicans litigated and legislated to say that, no, the constitutional census requirement is that you have an actual enumeration of the population, not a statistical inference. And they kind of won the day on that. And so now we have these sort of two parallel streams, these two different things the Census Bureau does. One is this ongoing effort to collect statistical information about the United States of America, including population estimates of cities and counties and states. And then the other is the census, quote unquote, that comes about every 10 years. And disconnecting these things had a lot of virtues, like from the standpoint of not letting partisan politics hamstring statistical data collection. But it also now raises a lot of questions about the basic integrity of the official census, because the stuff that stakeholders need, right, like American businesses like having accurate data about what's going on. It would be very inconvenient if there was no good way to look up how many people live in Rhode Island, right? Like you want to know that kind of stuff. But now that all of that is done totally separately from the official census, it's like the sky's the limit in terms of monkey business. And so it's like, if the people running the government like don't actually want people who live in cities to be counted, they're now in charge of running this survey, and they're not really motivated to have the survey be accurate. And like, that's where suspicion about things like a citizenship question comes in, right? Like, simply saying like, it would be good to know how many of the people living in different places are immigrants is like completely legitimate, right? Like, this is a piece of information people have all kinds of totally valid reasons to look up. But the concern is that not just that it might lead to undercounting, but that you might want to create undercounting, because it's not relevant to just the sort of curiosity question of like how many people in Idaho are foreign born. It's this kind of much more specific, much more politicized thing in a way that I becomes very troubling.
Yeah, no, this is, I mean, and this is also where the concern about, you know, I know that in theory, this isn't supposed to be a coronavirus episode, but like, it's really hard to talk about this without thinking about, for one thing, the fact that whether to have face-to-face interactions with people is currently a subject of some political valence. Mm-hmm. And also, on the other hand, the fact that both the state and federal budgets are going to look totally different than we thought they were going to look when census forms got shipped out pre-April 1st, which was, you know, nominal census date. It seems both that states are going to need any help they can get in terms of people filling out census forms, and that spending priorities are just going to look totally different because, you know, the federal government has spent gajillions approximately of dollars on things that aren't the bread and butter census tract rated, you know, social programs where having maximal numbers really counts.
Yeah. I mean, so should we take a break and then talk about pandemic issues specifically?
Yeah,
here?
I think that that's a context we got to get to.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Somewhat conveniently, this was the cycle that the Census Bureau decided they wanted to finally make the switch to trying to do the census primarily online, totally separate from the pandemic. But the 2010 census, even though the internet was a well-established technology at that point, was still mostly done as a sort of pen and paper through the mail kind of thing. And the decision was made for 2020, we're going to try to do an online census. Then when the census happened to converge with the pandemic, I think that was probably nice. And, you know, a lot of people, I did my census online. I hope you guys did. I hope anybody listening to this will do it. It's really quick and easy. It is the cheapest way for the government to survey you. It does not involve anyone doing anything potentially hazardous. We are all spending more time sitting around our houses these days. It's moderately entertaining. So in a way, that was like a small blessing, but it had there were long-standing questions about, like, how well would this actually work? Because it's not what people were used to. The IT infrastructure, people had a lot of questions about, because sometimes government websites don't function. But it seems to have gone fine, right? Like, I had read a lot of kind of hazy worries about this. But it the website works fine. I mean, not everybody has done it. But you've always had a thing. It used to be they would just mail something to you and you're supposed to mail it back. But lots of people wouldn't. And so then the census needs to try to send people around to sort of find you. Now, remember, I used to live in a big apartment building, and the woman who lived next door to me, I don't know why, like, she hadn't handed in her census form. And in 2010, they were, like, dogged, and they kept, like, trying to hunt her down. They knocked on my door. They were like, oh, do you know where she is? So, I have no idea. You know, it's a big city. I don't know her name, anything like that. But that seems challenging under these circumstances, where I think people are maybe less likely than usual to want to stop and chat with total strangers knocking on their doors.
Right. And I think that the coronavirus, we talked a little bit about the chilling effect of the Trump administration's efforts to count undocumented people. But I also think that the pandemic itself has had a chilling effect on these numbers. Because even if you're supposed to practice social distancing and avoid being in face-to-face contact with people you don't know, hello, person from the census who is coming to your home to have a conversation with you face to face with a person you do not know. And so I think that one of the challenges here also is that the census is a voluntary effort. And so much of this is based on not just responding to where people live or what people are doing, but also to individuals across the country saying, like, I will take part in this. And I have for our household, Matt, you mentioned that you did, I'm sure Dara has, but I think that the pandemic, it adds in an extra element of it chills a response to it. And it chills a response that was already, especially under administrations, I was thinking about this with in relation to something else, that one of the challenges here is that for many people, the federal government that is orchestrating the census is the same federal government that they largely distrust about most things for varied and frequently good reason. And so I think that one of the major challenges here is not just that the coronavirus pandemic has put census data collection into question, but that it has added another series of questions to an already, I think for many people, confusing interaction with the government.
Then, of course, there's the whole fact that the census is one of the bigger temporary employers in the country. The hiring of census takers, the people who are supposed to be doing follow-ups for those who, you know, don't fill out their census forms initially. There's a certain process by which, you know, if you haven't received something from an address you're supposed to send somebody, you can't quite impute that someone is there if that you don't get a census form from them, but you can, the purpose of kind of hiring this army of census takers is to make sure that you've done your darndest if you suspect someone might exist who might not have filled out their census form to get them to do so. That hiring surge was happening in March.
March.
And, well, or, you know, it was happening in... It, through the first quarter of this year, but as like large trainings were happening, there were lots of concerns about, should we maybe take this online? You know, should can we continue to train when the first states were issuing, you know, shelter in place orders, that kind of thing. So not only has that been a massively disrupted timeline, although it's kind of getting back on track now as, you know, the census has kind of reconfigured its timeline, but also is another confounding factor in what's been a massive economic collapse, right? In which a lot of people who really needed jobs at the beginning of this year weren't getting paychecks when they thought they were going to be getting paychecks because their census duties were, you know, they were essentially like pre-furloughed because census work was suspended for a time. There's also in states that are hiring a lot of contact tracers, you know, a question of the available pool. Are you, you know, if you sign up to be a contract tracer because you didn't think your census job was coming in and then the census actually does ramp up hiring, it's probably not the most substantial population, but it certainly does raise questions now that we have these kind of two simultaneous public sector hiring surges going on. So one of my questions, you know, way back when it became clear that there were a lot of people losing work in the first weeks of shutdown orders was what this was going to do to census employment, which is typically, I think, big enough that you can actually see it in jobs reports. Matt, tell me if I'm wrong. Like, it's substantial. And so we now, you know, this is now something that is in theory getting back online, but in a more physically attenuated form such that the kind of army of door knockers that are the bulk of the hiring are probably not going to be as big a boost as they would have been in an economy that needed them much less.
Yeah, census hiring is normally huge, and you need to do statistical adjustments during census years to sort of catch the underlying thread of the economy because it really distorts it. And so I had on my assignment list as of late February to write about the challenge of doing census hiring in a full employment economy, which actually hadn't happened since way back really in the 1960 census, at which point the female labor force participation rate was much, much lower. And there was this kind of pool of like moms you would dip into to do door knocking. So it was interesting. I had some good sources, people who had worked on the census in high levels in the past. Obviously, that has all become moot. It is not challenging to find people who have been laid off or temporarily furloughed to go work. So the question remains, how, going forward, would you conduct a census in an economy with a very low unemployment rate and no pool of unemployed homemakers to tap? The world may never know. This is one of these things where, you know, I feel a little monkey's paw about it. It's also worth sort of just going over the stats, right? So last time around, 66.5% of households self-reported on the census. So far, we are at 59.6% self-report. So we are running a bit behind. There is still more time left. So really, if you have not filled out your census online, you should. Like, ask your friends about this. It's important. It's good to know. The champion state, Minnesota, is at almost 70%. But the worst state is Alaska, down at a mere 40%. This is all sort of available up online. The Census Bureau has a tableau, a public tableau page that has this like whole great dashboard. You can see everything about what's going on. Also shows that even though there's incredible amount of concern specifically about undercounting in urban areas and particularly of urban non-white populations, most of the lowest response states are places like Alaska, West Virginia, Wyoming, Maine, Vermont, actually very rural and very white places. I assume because the internet connectivity levels are so much worse there?
Yeah. The census began back in January, was kind of kicked off in a native village in Alaska. But those are the areas where basic internet connectivity and any face-to-face interaction, even before coronavirus, would be extraordinarily difficult. You know, if you live in Juneau or Fairbanks or even in, you know, in rural West Virginia, a lot of this was deeply challenging anyway. And so yeah. I think that that's going to be the thing, because there has been, as Matt mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of concern about urban areas and undercounting, especially because of losing potential funding. But I think that in rural areas, the rural areas that you would think many Republicans would want extra focus on as kind of the cementation of political power through that means, they're not getting very much assistance either.
I mean, this is also where the kind of two-phase nature of the census makes it difficult to tell what is, like, gosh, this is a really dumb analogy, but it's the one I'm thinking of, so I'm going to run with it. In the same way that when you look at someone presenting for, like, for a temperature check for coronavirus, you can't tell just from that temperature check if they're asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, like if they're going to develop symptoms, you know, because they're still carrying the virus. You can't necessarily tell at this particular snapshot in time which of the places with low response rates are still going to have low response rates once the second in-person phase of the census fully ramps up, right? Like in communities where traditionally you don't have a high response phase that is self-initiated, but once census takers come through, you know, they get a lot of people to fill out forms. Right now, we haven't seen the full effect of that kind of second phase of things. So the big question is, if in normal years, your community is likely to have a lot of added people showing up once the census taker completes the physical rounds, this year, with the census taker coming later because of coronavirus, is there also going to be a fear of, you know, encountering strangers and a desire to socially distance, et cetera, that is going to make you less likely to answer the door? Or if you're in a rural area, are you fairly convinced that you're well insulated and, you know, either for ideological or like logistical reasons, less worried about opening the door to somebody you don't know?
Right. Well, and you don't. So the census's official response to the pandemic issue has been to sort of push the timelines back a couple of months. And that, I mean, I don't want to just get back into like baseline coronavirus podcasting, but it just sort of raises the question of what do we expect that shift of the time window to achieve, right? That a lot of implicit thinking about many things that's going on seems to just sort of suggest that by this fall, the situation will be dramatically different or better than it is now. And so just kind of shifting things into later in the year will solve problems related to the pandemic. But it's not in any way obvious that that's true. I mean, it might be true, right? Like I can't forecast the future. But like when you talk to the vaccine people, they're not saying like vaccine's going to be on the shelf by Labor Day. And when you talk to people who are interested in weather, they're saying, if anything, it'll be worse come fall. We're nowhere near like a herd immunity type level on this.
And we don't even know, again, if herd immunity is possible or if that's a thing or if you can have it multiple times. And no, this is not a coronavirus podcast, but everything is a coronavirus podcast nowadays.
Right. I mean, honestly, this is something that I've been thinking about a little bit because, you know, I'm working on a piece that is totally unrelated to this, but that also requires doing a little bit of, remember, we were learning new things every week in March. And so something that looks really dumb and non-responsive from the perspective of May was in fact the cutting edge of our understanding in March. The Census Bureau's response was a very, very quintessential early to mid-March response, right? It was the response of like competent, intelligent people who were seeing a lot of things about the importance of flattening the curve so that hospitals wouldn't be overwhelmed and there would be a manageable load of coronavirus cases for a longer period of time. So in that respect, yes, spreading things out over a longer amount of time, not having this very concentrated burst of one person going from house to house to house to house to house, does make a certain amount of sense because yes, you're going to be spreading out those interactions in such a way that you're reducing the total number of infections by a little bit, but what's more important is that you're reducing the number of infections at any one time. That has both kind of receded in importance to a certain extent as the attention has begun to shift to what would it take to return to some semblance of normality that wouldn't, you know, rocket the economy into the ground? And it assumed a certain amount of speedy government response on things like testing that would allow for a quicker resumption that hasn't yet materialized, right? Like, there were a lot of things that a lot of people did, including parts of the federal government, in early to mid-March to build the space for the rest of the federal government to come up with a coronavirus response. And part of that was what the Census Bureau did. And the rest of the federal government was not forthcoming.
Yes. I mean, the flip side is like the data's been good over the past few weeks. I mean, it could be the case that it's fine to conduct this census in the fall. But I think Dara's point is the right one, that like the original plan was made on the basis of assumptions that in multiple different directions have become no longer operative. So it's just like the current philosophy in many states, and I think a growing number of states, is like, it doesn't matter if the pandemic's under control or not, we're going to just do more stuff and kind of hope for the best. And that's where I think you worry. I mean, there's a public health concern, but I mean, an accuracy concern then kind of peeps in. Because something I've heard in a lot of quotes, you know, like frustrated open it up type people are like, look, like if you want to stay home, that's fine. But like, I want to go out. And there's like a question of, does that work public health wise? But it really doesn't work data collection wise, right? Because we're saying, okay, people are just going to make their own choices about their individual vulnerability. But if you are 75 and like many 75-year-olds, not necessarily the most like internet fluent person who is like really like an early adopter of new census technologies, you may be given the message that like things are opening up and you are supposed to isolate at home for your own good. And then people come at the door and they're like, well, I want to ask you like about where you live and when you were born. And it's really important because we need the funding for the schools. You're maybe not going to do that, right? Like in a super understandable way, especially because the official message you may be receiving is that you shouldn't do that, even while people are saying you should do the census. And then that's on top of like traditional concerns about people with unstable housing or low levels of sort of trust in the government. It's weird to be doing this at a time when we are anticipating now, I think, not a society-wide move on social distancing, but a kind of individualized, you do what you want, you make an individual risk assessment. Because you always know, like, no matter what the objective level of risk is, 5% of people are going to be way more paranoid than the leading experts say you should be, right? I mean, right now, we mostly, when we talk about public health, we're talking about the people who are less cautious than the experts say you should be. But like on any issue, like whatever experts say you should be doing, there's like a range of like actual human responses to that. And, you know, it's a country of millions of people. And the nature of this methodology is that, like, you really are supposed to get, like, literally every nose counted. And if people are ducking other people because there's no, like, society-wide measures to maintain safety, it just seems inevitable that a lot of people will go missing. I mean, the internet way is super easy. Like, I don't want to underplay that. And like, you could do it on your phone and all kinds of stuff. But like, some people don't have that stuff. And particularly, I think older people, like, you know, even if they do have smartphones, like don't know how to use them. And in many cases, don't have them. And it then piles on with the fact that, like, it's not obvious to me that, like, the president and the other people he's working with here, like, even care or want the population to be counted accurately. Makes it very disturbing. It's like, it's hard to do well under the best of circumstances. And then it's like, they're maybe not going to try.
I will say that if you look back at news coverage from previous decennia, it is highly traditional, even in like normal census times, to have a wave of coverage about undercounting is a big problem. And it's particularly a problem in already disadvantaged areas. And like, what if the undercount is so bad this year that it really skews the shape of the census? Broadly speaking, that has not panned out in the way that kind of the most worried people believed. Yes, there are concerns about undercounting, but we don't have evidence from previous censuses of the kind of differential skew that makes things really problematic, because at the end of the day, the ways in which the census matters are distributive, right? They're like, if everyone is undercounted roughly the same, if all groups are undercounted roughly the same extent, like no harm, no foul. So, you know, it is worth kind of saying that while this time is different, sometimes you can project bad outcomes that do not necessarily occur, and the census does have a long track record of that. That said, of course, you know, this time really is different, and it's not, especially because no one can push the census to post hoc, like skew the results one way or the other, for better or worse. The question of, is the federal government investing in the kind of very resource-intensive outreach effort that has traditionally saved the undercounting concerns from becoming real? Like, if you're worried about what message is being sent by elites regarding census participation, and you have an army of people on the ground saying, no, 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 those concerns aren't real, it, in the past, that has been more or less sufficient. So the question of what the government is doing and can do to execute a traditional census operation that has the successes that traditional census operations have is a big question, and one that we don't necessarily have a lot of insight to, because the operation of all of this has changed so much in the last few months. And for obvious reasons, Congress, which has a pretty strong incentive to do robust census oversight, has had other things on its mind.
Right. And I think that this census was, as Dara has detailed, and as we've talked about, was pre-coronavirus already so fraught in terms of, you know, counting undocumented folks, but also how cities were to be perceived and how congressional districts were going to be drawn and how existing population changes were going to be cemented in the census. Population changes that we already knew about. Thinking about the trends that we've noticed across the board in terms of who's moving where and how that impacts what politics will look like, how cities have grown, what cities have grown. All of this information, we were looking to this census to either say this is continuing as expected, or this is the end point that we thought we might get, or this is the end point we didn't know we would get. And all of that was already going to take place. And then we had a pandemic. And now we're in this space where the information we need to prove the point that so many of us have been focused on or thinking about is going
and
to be.
No one necessarily needs to dispute, right? It's right. Not like, oh, we need to settle this argument. It's we don't get to enter the answer, even if we all know it, until we've shown our work.
Yes, this is the most infuriating algebra test ever, where, you know, we know why the cities of El Paso, Houston, Dallas, and Austin have increased in size, but apparently we have to, like, show the exponent to prove why it happened, and now we can't do that effectively because of a pandemic. I hate math.
Is this really math?
It's mathy.
It's mathy. I guess there are numbers involved.
Don't like them.
So that is like math. It is math adjacent.
Counting is math.
Okay. Yeah. It's my 5-year-old, I guess, has moved beyond the counting phase of his math education, but it was in there.
Quantitative. We'll put it that way.
Quantitative skills. Yes. Exactly. Okay. Let's take a break. Let's talk about a white paper which has some more complicated math.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person who knows the business inside and out. Yeah. Yep. Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAC.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
Oh, yeah. And do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy. when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wisconsin held a judicial election recently, and there was a lot of controversy about whether they could move to universal vote by mail instead of voting in person. This was a big story, widely covered in the media. There was a lot of concern raised that allowing people to vote in person would spread coronavirus significantly. Also concerned that people to avoid getting coronavirus wouldn't vote. At any rate, the election went forward. Democrats did not get their way in terms of absentee voting. Republicans lost the race anyway, so they did not get their way, which was to win. And now we have research as to whether these health fears were validated, coming from a lot of authors on this: Chad Cotty, Brian Engelhart, Joshua Foster, Eric Nessen, and Paul S. Niekamp. And they find that consolidating of polling locations and in-person voting has significantly increased positive testing rates 2 to 3 weeks after the election. So basically, all the concerns that were raised here seem validated. We can't trace people with the level of granularity that would allow you to say, like, yes, definitely, COVID-positive people went to vote and then spread the infection to other people there. But we can tell that with the 2 to 3 week lag that you normally look for in these kinds of things, that the places where there was more in-person voting had more infections. So that sure seems like what people feared was going to happen did in fact go happen. I mean, the good news is it didn't, like, subsequently rage like wildly out of control, like Wisconsin didn't become the next New York or whatever. But yeah, like a bunch of people got sick, potentially some people died, also Republicans could try to win a race that they lost anyway.
I think one piece of this that was particularly interesting is that they mentioned towards the end about location consolidation, and that the idea of voting clerks want to make changes that lead to having fewer places to vote that are more consolidated and easier, in their view, for them to handle. However, that increases voter density. And that's been a big concern even before coronavirus with respect to access to voting in many states, in which you have fewer places to vote and longer lines at places to vote, which some people think is cool and awesome, and I think is less cool and awesome, because I think more people should be given access to the vote at all times, because that's just how I am. But again, this is another case of the context of voting was already not great, and then there was a pandemic. And so I think that it's interesting how this paper gets at the idea of this is a policy consideration for county and municipal clerks, that voting consolidation could be, or consolidating voting locations could be a potential concern for COVID-19. But that only really matters to county and municipal clerks if the risk of transmitting COVID-19 is seen as being a bigger threat than the risk of a lot of people voting for people perhaps they don't want them to vote for.
Right. I mean, this is also where the question of who gets to vote absentee becomes relevant. You know, there is substantial evidence that there are a lot of older voters who vote early or vote absentee, and that those aren't necessarily the people who are targeted by efforts to reduce earlier absentee voting. If, in theory, you are the kind of politician who is indifferent to the well-being of people who didn't vote for you, which admittedly is like a really terrible thing to say that anyone would be, but such a hypothetical person might not necessarily feel as concerned about voting consolidation because, A, if you're going to scare some people away from voting by not showing up in the long line, that's great. And B, if your voters aren't the ones who are putting their health at risk, maybe that's less of a concern to you. That's horrible. And I'm not saying that, like, any politician, much less any specific politician involved in, like, figuring out this Wisconsin election actually had that calculus. It's just one of the ways that the, you know, the question of which lives matter regarding coronavirus, right? Like, when a magnitude of deaths is acceptable versus when is it unacceptable takes on unavoidably political connotations. The one thing that I will say that is actually very heartening about this paper, though, is that we're talking about something that happened a matter of weeks ago. And not only is this already available as like a preprint on the NBER site, but it's already got a fairly robust lit review section on all of the other evidence we have of when political and ideological behavior affects coronavirus infection. Like, there has been such a massive surge of intellectual energy toward coronavirus, not just in the biological sciences, where, of course, we've seen this like wild proliferation of studies of infection and just a lot of energy being put to making science available much more quickly than standard academic gatekeeping would allow it to be, but also in the social sciences that's really giving us a much more robust sense of what's going on right now than you typically see. Like, if you're a journalist who wants to be grounded in the social science of what you're writing about, you can't actually be grounded in the social science of the thing you're writing about, because that's going to take several years to develop. And if you're lucky, we'll cite you when it does. But in this case, it really is possible to like make much more informed predictions in the first two segments of this episode because of the kind of research that we're talking about in the third segment.
Thank you, social scientists, for taking the time to write these, to do this research and write these papers.
I saw a chart and it was like, it was showing the exponential growth of coronavirus-related papers circulating in preprint or working paper form. And it's actually kind of funny. But yeah, I mean, it seems like academics all across America, medical scientists, epidemiologists, everybody with social science, quantitative skills has sort of really been having a go at publishing some different stuff. To an extent, you know, I look at the NBER papers every week. And I sometimes want to urge America's economists to slow down and publish some research on other topics, too, because you got to think, you know, especially the economists out there in the audience about marginal value and comparative advantage and things like that. You know, how many coronavirus papers are we expected to read in any given week just to kind of find the good ones, you know?
Like, right. Yes. Social scientists of America should be on notice that like this week we did a coronavirus paper. But, you know, we're probably going to be looking for something different next week. So
exactly. We are ready to hear new research on other topics. We are eager.
Our inbox is open. Our Facebook group is ready to discuss. We are here. We are ready for the great latest and greatest in social science. You know, some Swedish administrative data would really make this time pass
liberate
more enjoyably.
The Swedish administrative data.
Okay, but Swedish administrative data now would just be telling us more COVID stuff, right?
Maybe the separate administrative data.
Sweden is such a hot spot for like yelling about coronavirus.
This
data.
Is actually a really good point. We probably owe it to everyone. If you are a listener who knows of a coronavirus paper that draws on Swedish administrative data, please send it to us.
Yeah, yes. That'd be good. We should do that one. Okay. So thanks, guys. Thanks, everybody out there listening. Thanks, as always, to Jeffrey Geld, our producer. And The Weeds will return on Friday.
Hooray!